Hi there, everybody. This is Armand DeMille with you at The Positive Mind, here on WBAI 99.5 FM on your dial. Bringing you ideas, concepts, guests, help you lead a more positively minded life. And today you're going to learn something, my friends. Let's start off with this. Capgras syndrome. People with Capgras syndrome act as if they're in a parallel universe in which people they know are doubles or imposters. Now, this is when people with Capgras syndrome see a friend, spouse, or themselves in a mirror. They believe they're seeing an exact double or an imposter. Sometimes people with Capgras syndrome even believe that inanimate objects such as a chair, a watch, a book, or a lamp have been replaced by exact replicas. If people own a pet, they think the pet has been substituted by someone else. Some people talk about it as alien invasion, and they're often so disturbed when they see this doppelganger in the mirror that they remove all mirrors from their home. Now, this syndrome, which is named after a psychiatrist, Jean-Marie Capgras, French, afflicts thousands of people in the United States. There are thousands of people walking around out there who believe that somebody has substituted everybody they know for someone else. It seems very often as a form of schizophrenia or a symptom of schizophrenia, but it's very prevalent, and the people could stay functional. It reminds you of the movie The Invasion of the Body Snatchers. You remember The Invasion of the Body Snatchers? In the studio with me, Linda Vanella. Linda, you didn't see The Invasion of the Body Snatchers, did you? Because you would never see that movie.
No, I never saw that, Armand.
Well, you're going to have to see that movie.
I will, for sure.
Okay. Just be one of the ones you'd avoid. All right, today we're talking about something else very important. I'm lucky to have in the studio with me Jeffrey Abugel, A-B-U-G-E-L, who has suffered with and dealt with and written a wonderful piece of work about a thing called depersonalization. Of all the books I ever saw on depression, the most popular one, or the one that seems to be the best, is the one written by somebody who went through it. Depersonalization has been something which we, the mental health community, has struggled with for years trying to define. Let me do this by introducing you to probably the person with the most knowledge of this syndrome, because he studied it, because it hasn't been studied that much. So let me introduce Jeffrey to you. Jeffrey, welcome to WBAI.
How are you?
I'm good.
Good.
How are you is actually more
I'm doing well.
Or all of you are doing well?
No, there's just one of me.
Okay. And but there used to be one of you, and there used to be a part of you that just sat by and watched.
Well, excessive self-observation is certainly a characteristic of depersonalization disorder. Technically, DPD, as it's called, is a dissociative disorder in the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual, DSM-4. And it has several different symptoms, one of which is watching yourself, excessive rumination about all kinds of things that are not particularly relevant, so there's an obsessive quality to it. But the overall feeling with depersonalization disorder is one of strangeness. Your inner world feels strange, your outer world feels strange, which is often called derealization. And there's a sense that your mind is no longer attached to your body in the way that it was before. So it's not an out-of-body experience per se, but you may feel as if there's no longer that connection that you once felt. So as a result, you're thinking about this all the time and trying to figure out what's wrong.
So it's a feeling of watching yourself act while having no control over a situation.
Yes, many people describe it as if you're watching yourself in a movie, That's probably the most common. But it really stems from what's known as anomalous body experience. In other words, you no longer feel integrated with your body. Your mind is the same mind. You're thinking the same things you did. The only difference is you're so worried now about what's wrong with you because of this feeling of separation that you monitor your behavior, and often you act just going through the motions of life because you don't know what's wrong with you, and you think you're going crazy, and you don't want other people to think you're going crazy, so you become like a robot, and certainly lack of emotion stems from this as well.
So if a person derealizes or depersonalizes, they step outside of themselves in a way. But now, I imagine there are times you want to do that. There are times like in crisis, when you're having a fire, when you're in a war, when you're something like that, or if you're being tortured or beaten, stepping outside your body. Now, that's called dissociation. How do we distinguish dissociation from depersonalization?
Well, the dissociative response in human beings is thought to be a very ancient normal response to stress or extreme stress, such as the situations you've described. In that sense, it helps to separate the individual from the traumatic circumstances, but it's supposed to go back to normal once those circumstances are over. You're supposed to reconnect, and that, for the moment, had saved you.
Dissociation is like a reaction, is what you're saying.
It's thought to be a very ancient protective mechanism.
Okay.
Sort of like a possum playing possum. He's threatened, and he suddenly will lay down and appear to be dead and go into a little trance state, perhaps. But depersonalization is different, and it's thought to be a dysfunction of this normal dissociative reaction so that it lingers. And as it does linger, it goes through a whole slew of symptoms of its own, and they're very unpleasant, whereas dissociation itself can be somewhat pleasant, but at least it's saving you from a traumatic circumstance.
So let's say a person makes me immediately think of drugs. You know, certain drugs that people would do, and, you know, ecstasy or ketamine or any of these other drugs that may take you outside yourself. LSD, you can kind of look back and you wonder where you are, but you know you're taking a drug. And that may save you. And then there's what they call the bad trip, which is probably being depersonalized and derealized and not knowing a cause, you know, having a panic about it.
Yeah.
So people do this on purpose. They take drugs so that they could depersonalize, don't they?
Certainly during certain drugs like LSD and ketamine, which is an anesthetic that is known as the dissociative anesthetic, these things do separate you from yourself for a while, and in some cases, that's something to be sought. The problem with depersonalization disorder is that it lingers, and it's relentless and unremitting, and you cannot return to where you were before. It doesn't wear off. It just keeps going. So as a result, it creates all kinds of problems for people, and they have to seek treatment.
So, Jeffrey, when you went through this.
Mm-hmm.
Can you talk about it as the hell of it? What was the hell of it? What did it feel like in its worst?
Well, initially it was triggered by an acute panic attack, which in turn had been triggered by smoking pot. And I am not an anti-drug person per se. I think there's a time and a place for everything. But certainly certain people have a predisposition towards depersonalization disorder. And there are certain triggers that people will use that can cause DPD. Now, normally, depersonalization disorder can be caused by kind of a low-level stress, such as an early verbal abuse during childhood or other nominal stresses. But one of the other triggers they found is certain categories of drugs. Marijuana, ketamine, as I mentioned, LSD, ecstasy has caused quite a few number of cases, and salvia, which is perfectly legal in most of the United States.
How about alcohol?
There hasn't been shown to be a link between alcohol and depersonalization per se, which is not to say it doesn't happen.
So, in other words, a person may dissociate and depersonalize when they're doing alcohol, because certainly I've known when I've, you know, been three sheets under at some point that I barely knew where I was and what I was.
This is true, and this is true of a lot of drugs when you're under the influence of that drug. But the difference is with alcohol, normally you'll wake up, you'll have a hangover, and you'll move on.
And you'll be back home.
Right. And so these particular drugs that we're talking about serve as triggers. So in other words, we're not saying that the drugs directly cause depersonalization. What they've done is trigger a pre-existing diathesis that exists in the person. And so it could be stress, and it could be this categories of drugs that throw people into long-term DPD.
So you had a propensity for this, obviously. Yeah. And so then you did something that had to do with marijuana, and you got very anxious, and you had a panic attack. Mm-hmm. And then you depersonalized.
Exactly.
And what was it like? Was that like hell? Was that like, what's the matter with me?
Well, the immediate reaction, remember, this was about 30 years ago, and very little was known either about marijuana.
That's what I'm thinking about you. I'm thinking about poor you, 30 years ago.
Well, you had heard stories at that time about kids who had blown their brains out or had done different things because of a bad trip with drugs. And I thought that the, as most people will think, that the pot was laced with something. And once I got assurance that it wasn't, it really didn't serve to help the situation because the panic was quite intense. The difference was I was perfectly normal the next day. And then for a series of 2 or 3 days, late at night, these panic attacks came back. Now, very few people even knew what a panic attack was back then. I mean, there was no way to describe what I was feeling. So I thought I was losing my mind. Well, after about a week or so of these persistent, ongoing panic attacks, everything changed. Something happened. And I became very calm, but I was no longer me. Something had changed in me. And what I was experiencing then was depersonalization, although I didn't know what it was at the time.
And it was uncomfortable even though you became calm?
It was certainly more bearable than nonstop panic attacks, but it was very uncomfortable because I felt a distinct disconnection between my thinking brain, my spirit, as it were, and my body, and I could find no way to get them reconnected. In other words, as a result of that, you wander around all day totally obsessed with what's wrong with you and trying to find help and begin, everything appears differently because you lose your emotional attachment to the things around you. And so the end result is thinking without feeling, which can be a pretty terrifying thing because virtually everything we think has some emotional context. But if you remove the emotion, thinking become a little frightening and it can go in all kinds of strange directions. So it's a very nightmarish experience.
Feelings. Are feelings important? I mean, you're saying you're thinking without feeling, so during this period of time when you have this depersonalization, you're not feeling your normal self? You're not feeling? There's no emotion?
It's kind of a contradiction because one of the symptoms of DPD is a lack of affect or a lack of emotion. But what really happens is the emotional context in which you held everything, all the aspects of your life, the people you know, the pictures and things around you, your car, you lose that strong personal connection. So you feel kind of like you're from Mars or something. You feel like you're fresh on the planet and everything's a little bit strange and life just becomes extremely uncomfortable. You really don't know what to do because you've lost your, I dare say you've lost the illusions that kept you going earlier. You may have had daydreams and thoughts about what you were going to be or going to do in life. And basically, it breaks down whatever defenses you have built up through a lifetime of living so that the things that keep you sane and keep you happy, they no longer have the strength that they had before.
So being happy is like almost alien to being depersonalized.
And so it's the complete antithesis. I don't believe there's such a thing as happiness.
A happy, depersonalized person.
Not at all, no.
Well, not unless you have it as a dissociated person.
Well,
you know, in multiple personality, you have somebody who's happy, but...
Well, it touches upon an interesting aspect of depersonalization, and I mentioned this in the book in some detail, but it's largely a Western phenomena. In Eastern cultures, depersonalization or dissociation are looked at completely differently. And arguably, someone could interpret the complete depersonalization or the complete destruction of the ego as the first step towards enlightenment. Now, we don't see things that way, and so we try to readjust and go back to where we were. But there have been people who have kind of followed this path a little further in meditative practices and tried to carry it the next step in terms of spiritual enlightenment. So it's a very strong philosophical and spiritual aspect to any discussion of depersonalization, and I've tried to bring this out in the book as much as possible.
War and the Soul, recent book, talks about feeling like you lost your soul during the war. Would you say, and then walking around with that feeling, would you say that those are familiar words to you?
Absolutely. In fact, in the book, I mentioned that at some point early on in life, my soul departed. And exactly how and when, I don't know, but I know the circumstances, and then it was suddenly gone.
The soul, as you're using the phrase, the soul, the word, it's our connection to ourselves. It's a connection to your inner heart, to your being, in a way that you know you're there. You know, you're a piece of yourself, whereas opposed to being separate from yourself. As so many people depersonalize in so many different ways.
This is true, and this is one of the problems with the term depersonalization. But if you look at it in the context of the loss of the person, whatever made you a person emotionally and mentally is suddenly starting to disappear or disappears completely, you really wind up kind of like a robot walking around the earth. Interestingly, your intellectual capacity is not diminished, so you can do a job very proficiently. The difference is, if you don't have a job to occupy your brain all the time, you go home and your life is totally different, kind of empty, so it's somewhat easy to become a workaholic if you're depersonalized.
You know, there's in psychiatry, depersonalization is the third most common psychological symptom after feelings of anxiety and feelings of depression. Depersonalization is a symptom of anxiety disorders, such as panic disorder, but it could accompany a lot of things, sleep deprivation, jet lag. You could feel depersonalized.
Absolutely.
You know, a lot of people have no idea, when am I going to land inside my body? It's like you traveled across the country, but you left your heart in San Francisco. No, wait, that could be a song. All right. Migraine sufferers? What about migraine sufferers now?
On a biological basis, the symptoms of depersonalization have appeared in people with temporal lobe epilepsy as well as people who suffer from migraines. So there is some biological connection there. And these things have only really started to have been studied in the last 10, 15 years or so.
Is this the fugue state or is it other part of it?
No. Depersonalization, as I said, is listed under dissociative disorders in the DSM-4, yet it has very little in common with the other dissociative disorders. And so a fugue state is one where you have an extended loss of memory, out-of-body experience, you literally see yourself from outside. DID, dissociative identity disorder, of course, is multiple personalities, and all these things involve loss of memory, loss of time. These things are not altered in depersonalization. You still know who you are, and what they say is reality testing remains intact, so you're always aware of the problem, and sometimes it makes it doubly painful because you are so aware of it.
Well, this chemistry changes. A study of undergraduate students found that the individuals high on the depersonalization scale exhibited a more pronounced cortisol response.
Yes.
So individuals high in the absorption, cortisol can be a very important part, whereas other people show a weaker cortisol response. What are the chemistry is in effect, or have what else have we learned about chemistry that tells us the status of the chemical brain during a dissociative disorder?
Well, and again, this has only been studied in the last 10 or 15 years, and initially it was thought to be a serotonergic response, and they thought it was related strictly to serotonin. A lot of that was based on the compulsive and obsessive aspects that can come with depersonalization. So the difference is it can involve the opioid system. It may involve the
neurotransmitters.
Well. There are three or four different biological systems that may be involved in depersonalization, and they have yet to sort it out. Now, I go through each of these in the book so that at least a person can understand what's being tried right now. They have had some success in terms of medication with anti-seizure medicines and with drugs that affect the opioid system, and to some degree combinations of drugs that have helped. But it's yet to be pinpointed.
You're in love with somebody who depersonalizes, and that's the way they go around, and they can't help it. What's your experience like as the mate of somebody who depersonalizes? What do you see happening to them?
Well, one of the biggest problem is with relationships, and people typically now, you know, I've talked to maybe 200 people who suffer from chronic depersonalization through the years via my website. And one of the real problems is the dysfunction with relationships. People who are depersonalized tend to go from one partner to another. They may become promiscuous sexually. Part of this stems from what may be viewed as the destruction of their personal self-worth, the personal sense of ego. And as a result, they're always grabbing at straws to try to give some validation to their existence or their relationship, and it just doesn't work. So it's not been a very good track record with relationships and long-term partners.
Well, if you look at promiscuity, for example, you're saying the person can have a lot of sexual partners, but since they're not there, since they're not in their body, who's having the experiences?
Exactly right. These sexual encounters are usually attempts, and there are a number of people who simply cannot perform because of depersonalization.
Attempts to find yourself? Is that what it is? Is that what it is? You're saying, let me go to bed with this person because maybe when I'm having sex with them, I'll be able to feel myself in some way.
Certainly that's part of it. It's a form of some kind of self-therapy. Now, other people drink. Other people do with other drugs to try to beat it. So there's always a way to try to find. And we're not talking in metaphors here. This is a literal loss of self, a literal loss of feeling of self that is very, very hard to deal with. And so people will go off in all kinds of directions, just trying to either preoccupy themselves, take their minds off what they're thinking about, and just feel normal for a few minutes.
Lieutenant Colonel Dave Grossman, in his book on killing, he wrote a book called Killing, suggests that military training artificially creates depersonalization in soldiers because it suppresses empathy, making it easier for them to kill other human beings.
It's certainly possible. Now, there are ways to depersonalize other people. Brainwashing would certainly be an example of that, and certain military training, certain things would, while dehumanizing the individual to a degree, will depersonalize them as well. The difference is the guy who carries a photo of his girlfriend or his mother in his wallet and always looks at it once a day, and you see how deeply you've gotten to him. So there is a difference. And certainly that type of stress, certain types of stress, even military training, or long-term abuse of some kind, on a lower level but ongoing, can trigger depersonalization in people who already have a predisposition towards a condition.
I've also seen, I should mention to people, the name of the book is Stranger to Myself, which is Inside Depersonalization, The Hidden Epidemic by Jeffrey Abugel, A-B-U-G-E-L. Jeffrey, I've also seen mob behavior result in kind of a group depersonalization, and I'm thinking about, you know, where you have a group of people suddenly joining into some kind of rageful experience, and they lose themselves. They're just lost, and it's...
That's an interesting point. I've seen that at Yankee Stadium sometimes. Certainly, when you're in a mob and you have one purpose, you kind of lose your individuality and you become part of that larger consciousness or that larger entity. But then again, that should be a temporary thing. The difference, again, with depersonalization disorder is it's undesired, you don't join up, it just comes to you, and then it lingers, and you have a heck of a time getting rid of it. So
it could be a reaction. You know, I wonder how many people who are currently in prison had a temporary depersonalized experience that resulted in them doing something that they would not normally do. And even though it was just a temporary experience, then they, you know, when they came back to themselves, they're already in jail.
This is an interesting point. There was a case in New England of a man who had committed murder, actually, and part of his defense, excuse me, was that he claimed that he had depersonalization disorder. And some people contacted me to ask me what my thoughts were, and my thoughts that would not be the case. Traditionally, depersonalized people tend to be introspective, reflective. They tend to ruminate. There's no clinical proof of this, but historically, if you look at the last the papers that have been done about depersonalization in the last 100 years, they reflect a certain type of intelligence or a certain amount of sensitivity that normally a person would not deviate from outwardly. So it's all inwardly driven. All the destruction in depersonalization is driven towards the self, towards the individual that is suffering from it, not towards other people.
Ralph Allison, who was my supervisor when I was treating multiple personality disorder, and he would, what's called dissociative identity disorder now. And Ralph was once questioned about, he was on trial, and he had somebody who dissociated on trial, dissociated now, and this person had committed a crime, and it was and the judge turned to Ralph Allison, and the personality that was on the stand at the moment was an alter personality. It wasn't the real self.
Right.
So he sees the person's on there, and the person's bragging about the crime he committed. So the judge said to Ralph Allison, "Is this man sick?" And Ralph Allison's response was, "No, Judge, that is the sickness."
Mm-hmm.
That you could see it right there, because mm-hmm. that person is not really a person.
Right.
It's the illness itself appearing.
Right.
Well, on depersonalized self, now let me ask you about depersonalized self. You have a mate. Your mate depersonalizes. They could live for a very long time, and they could just continue like this. And they're very unhappy. They're in a lot of grief. They're complaining a lot. What are they like?
Absolutely right. They reach a point normally where they just want their lives back. Interestingly, I've heard from dozens and dozens of married women who had children wanting to know, how can I possibly get my life back, to show my husband love, to be involved with my family. Because the best years of their lives are slipping by, because they feel as if they don't exist, and they're not feeling what they should from their family and enjoying the kids and the husband. And it's a real problem, because for many of these women, it lingers all through the time that the children are growing up. And so it's certainly a problem that people have to address head on and try to find some relief. And there are means of dealing with it. There are means of people. There are many success stories out there. Sometimes I'll get some complaints on my website from people who think that the site is too negative, or things I've written are too negative, when in fact it's only in the last 10 years or so we have seen tremendous advances in different types of therapies that can help, and different medications or combinations thereof that can help. So it's by no means a hopeless situation. Now, I will point out one thing. There has been some scant evidence that people who develop depersonalization disorder via drugs, it's triggered by drugs, if they stay away from the drug, typically their time for recovery will be a little quicker than those who can attribute it to some kind of abuse or some other kind of psychological issue. So there is hope in that sense. If you just refrain, you probably are going to improve.
There could be a condition, though, of which a person finds being depersonalized better than the condition they had before it, not just in reaction.
Absolutely.
So, you know, so what would that be? For example, let's say a person had some miserable neurological disorder where they were just completely in pain and torture all the time, and they learned to depersonalize, and they did depersonalize, and now they're depersonalized. They're not connected to what they feel anymore.
Well, this brings up the interesting point. That certainly could happen, and when it does happen, is it something that could happen to everyone because of the horrific circumstances? Or is it simply that same system being triggered in a person, the same thing that pot or other stresses would trigger? So it's really unknown. Certainly there have been situations where people intentionally dissociated or depersonalized, and an interesting study was done in the concentration camp where a group of psychiatrists learned to intentionally dissociate and remove themselves from the circumstances for the time that they were in the camp. So it is a possibility.
Thank you. Jeffrey Abigail, this is Armand DeMille with you with The Positive Mind. We're going to take a short break. When we come back, a little music, and then we will continue. This is Armand DeMille with you with The Positive Mind. We were talking to Jeffrey Abigail, who wrote a book called Stranger to Myself, and he talked about the depersonalization disorder, adapted from his book Stranger to Myself. Here's what depersonalization is. It's a feeling of panic. You feel like you're going crazy. You have a loss of emotion. You can't feel anything. You know, you're like, where's my heart? You're detached. You feel disconnected from people around you. And then you get obsessive and you're saying, what's real? What's not real? How do I get back? What's the matter with me? And you have this abstract rumination, which is dwelling on the idea of things like eternity, infinity. You become trapped in the thoughts of the void. And you can see that with many philosophers and scientists every now and then. You'll see them talking as if they're totally not there. Not there is a very interesting thing when a person's not there. They also feel they have lifestyle changes. They become afraid to leave their houses or engage in any type of activity that might trigger a panic attack. They stop traveling. They stop watching TV. They stop talking to people. They even stop going to doctors because it's a living hell, not feeling like you're with yourself. There's another thing called derealization, where you feel that everything around you is unreal in some way. But depersonalization is a much more common syndrome than anybody knows, and it's horrendous. But you see, if you had somebody, if you knew somebody who depersonalized, and I personally know a few people who tend to do that for moments at a time, but it's not always there because they come home. But if you know people who get like that under stress, you can't reach them. And the more you grab out to them to try to reach them, the further away they withdraw. This is Armand DeMille with you with The Positive Mind. How do you treat it? What's the story? Well, you know, what they found is that there are both medications that help people and there are also psychotherapy. And whatever psychotherapy is, by definition, it mainly means finding a place to feel safe enough to bring yourself back home. People with this syndrome of depersonalization often report feelings as if an evil entity has taken up residence inside their head, watching them and making negative comments. Now, Lindy, you were reading the book The Soul and War, right? Mm-hmm, and yes. What was the comparison there?
Well, it was a similar understanding of how when one is experiencing trauma, as in a war situation, the author describes that he actually felt that there was a soul or a being inside of him that left his body so that the soul can remain safely intact while the body underwent this traumatic experience. Very similar to what Jeffrey was mentioning before.
And you never get the soul back sometimes.
No, that's the whole
PTSD may be loss of soul.
Exactly.
Or loss of self in some way. And there's this acting as if. People with dissociative depersonalization disorder cause sufferers to feel as though they're acting, you know? You feel like you're acting. It's an act. They imitate people's moods and expressions. They try to act normal around others. But they continue to feel like outsiders who aren't part of ordinary life. And, or, there's a real popularity in schools and colleges. I think Lauren was mentioning something about depersonalization among the youth. Lauren?
Yeah, I think it's an interesting connotation with the acting out, because it's almost as if you're just not comfortable with yourself. So you use drugs as maybe a crutch. And I don't think children, or not children, but young adults are aware of the long-term effects that the drug abuse can have, not only physically, but mentally.
Yeah. You know what's so fascinating to me? What's fascinating to me is even though you're depersonalized, it doesn't stop you from having babies. If you're a depersonalized woman, you can become pregnant. You could have a child. If you're a depersonalized man, you could impregnate a woman. You could be the father to a child. Imagine having a parent who's depersonalized. Well, many people do. They're not home. They're not there. They don't feel real. They have certainly no connection with you, the child. I frequently, when I've talked to patients who've come to see me, as they describe their parents, I wonder to myself, were these parents depersonalized? This is Armand DeMille with you, with Linda Vanella, and on The Positive Mind here. We are talking about depersonalization, and we will take your telephone calls today at 212-209-2900. That's 212-209-2900. Some people say that it's a physical thing, that it kind of happens as the biology, you know, because it could be part of the chemistry of your brain. And one of the things I also like about the book was a good description of the human brain and how the brain works and the different parts of the brain. So I think you get a nice map to understand more of, you know, the different parts of yourself. It talks about the frontal lobe, your body and your mind. John Milton, the poet John Milton, said, "The mind is its own place. You can make a heaven out of hell or a hell out of heaven. Mind is one thing, something that only the individual truly knows, but brain and body are no longer perceived by educated people as two separate entities. They go together. It's not, you know, the body is one thing and the mind is another. They go together. And when they don't go together, therein, my friend, lies the rub." 212-209-2900. Let's take one of your calls. This is Armand DeMille. Hi, you're on the air. Hello there. Hi, you're on the air.
Hi, Armand. It's Rachel. I called you a few times. How are you?
Good, Rachel. Nice to hear from you.
Same here. I have a question for you, Armand. When you depersonalize, is there like varying degrees of depersonalization?
Yes, there are.
Okay. Is there a very, very mild form?
Yes. Tell me your form.
I don't think that I depersonalize. I've never done drugs. I've had a lot of stress in my life, but sometimes I feel like I know what I'm supposed to be feeling, and I just don't. So
yeah.
It's like an act to make sure, you know, that the feelings that are supposed to come across, let's say, to my children, do.
It's like if you put on the act and you say, I'm going to act as if I'm going to be a loving, wonderful mother.
Exactly.
But I don't feel it at the moment.
Exactly.
Yes. So I think that's exactly what we're talking about.
Okay.
But now that lasts for a little while and then you come out of it?
It's not like I come out of it. I know what a loving mother is supposed to be. And I, even though I acted, I can never really, really muster up the feelings,
yeah,
you know, that I'm supposed to have. And I think it's fear-based.
Yeah, I understand. I understand. Now, you never feel these feelings even when they're ill?
No, yes. When there is, like, an emergency, I do feel the feelings. Even, like, for instance, we had a little puppy. I can't feel for animals. I do go through the emotions. My daughter has a dog that she's very, very attached to. And often I babysit the dog. So I make sure that she's well taken care of and whatnot. And I don't feel the love that she's feeling for the dog.
Right.
And then what happened was at one time, one of the dogs got ran over by a car. I was devastated. Now all the feelings
flooded
you.
So yeah. There seems to be a thin veil between you and your emotions. It's there somewhere. And you hang out on one side of this door, you know, because this is the safer place. You'll observe. But you do have access to all your deep feelings. And it's like, if for some reason or other, you've decided to keep the two separate for now.
Mm-hmm.
And that through a crisis or something like that, you will re-engage and get close.
Mm-hmm.
How good are you at hugging, Rachel?
Oh, I'm great at hugging.
I'm great
at going through all the motions, even with my friends, and I know exactly what I'm supposed to be feeling.
So you hug wonderfully.
Yes.
But feel very little while you're doing it.
Yeah.
Okay, now listen, Rachel, have you ever hugged a tree?
A tree? No.
Yeah. Okay, would you do something for yourself?
Okay.
I want you to hug a tree and just hang out with the tree for a while. Find a tree that's just enough for you to get your arms around it.
Okay.
And this is not going to have a response to you, right? The tree's not going to come back and say something to you. I just want you to hug a tree and then find your soul while you're hugging a tree. Find your heart while you're hugging a tree.
What does that mean exactly?
That means let yourself feel. Just relax your mind and just feel the hug of the tree. Just feel the physical hug of it.
Okay. But yeah. I'm fearful even hugging a tree.
Yeah, I know you are.
Yeah. It's very scary.
But it's only a tree.
Yeah.
you know? I know it is. I understand. Yeah. But that'll be a good way for you to actually practice finding yourself, letting yourself land back home.
And feel.
Yeah.
Okay. Thank you so much.
My pleasure, Rachel. Thanks for calling in. 212-209-2900. This is Armand DeMille. Let's take another call. Hi, you're on the air. Hello there.
Hi.
Hi. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Oh, hi. Very interesting. I just had a question or a comment, I suppose. So I feel like I have this, but I also have been diagnosed with PTSD. But I was listening to Jeff Brady last night in other news, and he was talking about the possibilities of electromagnetic waves altering people's brain chemistry and so forth. In other words, external depersonalization. Let's just use that phrase, maybe. I was wondering whether you were familiar with any the HAWP project or...
I'm not familiar with the projects, but it certainly makes sense to me that we could easily shake up the system through the electromagnetic field enough so that we could disconnect. I'm sure if we did brain studies, which we could do nowadays by imaging, I'm sure we would find that when we're imaging, there are certain things that will react and cause a person to feel that depersonalization. Now, you also have another thing probably related to military service. Is that right?
Correct.
Right. And in military service, do you remember being trained to, in effect, depersonalize when you're in a crisis?
Yes. Basic training did that very well.
That's what basic training is.
Yeah.
And supposedly, you get through crisis better that way. And then when you do it for a period of time, especially if you wind up serving in a place where, you know, there's actual war, it's very hard to come back from that and find yourself. It's very hard.
That's for sure.
And you've been working at it, right? You've been trying?
I've been trying, yeah. It's always a battle.
Who do you love?
My grandchildren.
You love your grandchildren. So they cross the bridge with you, right?
Oh, absolutely.
They cross the gap. That's what I think grandchildren are really for. I don't think we're supposed to take care of them. I think they're around to take care of us.
We spoil them and they take care of us. I like that.
Yeah, I like it too. Thanks a lot for calling in. My pleasure.
Appreciate it. Bye.
212-209-2900. Just one comment, you know, just to show you how deeply this runs. We know that serotonin can play a huge role in our moods. And that a depletion of serotonin could easily lead to kind of a disconnection with your body. But, you know, serotonin starts in the gastrointestinal system. It's not just a brain function. The gastrointestinal system possesses its own self, a contained nervous system, a mind of its own, so to speak, called the enteric nervous system. Now, 95% of our serotonin is manufactured in the bowel before showing up in the brain. So your gut instinct about something can be very, very effective because it may actually tell you, be giving you a message that's true. Whereas we all think it's all up in our brain. It's all our thinking brain self. Well, there's a gut self. So this is how complex it is to try to understand ourselves. We work hard at it. 212-209-2900. Let's take another call. This is Armand DeMille. Hi, you're on the air. Hello there.
Hello?
Yes.
Yeah, how you doing?
Good.
Okay. I'm calling about that demonization topic you got going on.
Yeah, right now.
Okay.
Tell me
what
about
it. What do you do? Well, you know, I was kind of like really identifying it. I didn't know what my situation kind of fell underneath it. But I'm like, you know what, I'm engaged to get married, and I don't know, man. I just feel like I don't feel connected with a lot of things. Like, I feel like the other lady I spoke about, I'm smiling, but I'm not smiling a lot of times. Now, I'm a recovering drug addict, too. I've been sober for 2 years. You know, so I know that this has a lot of stuff to do with it, but it's like, no matter what happens in my life, it's like I just ran into a $100,000 settlement, and it's like nothing I buy. seems to, I don't know if that's dehumanization or depersonalization, right?
Yes. Let me ask you something, though. So you're, yes, you're getting married, but you can't locate your feelings towards your mate, right?
I can't locate it. I don't want to separate, but the...
Is that the only choice? Is the only choice either get married or separate? You know,
so I see it, yeah.
Do you, yeah, lose, do you lose her if you don't want to marry her?
No, not necessarily, because there's children involved.
Yeah, I understand. Well, how do you feel towards your children?
I feel great toward my children.
Do you feel connected to them?
Yeah, I feel connected, and then sometimes I feel disconnected, and, you know, just at moments, but not really, no, I don't feel disconnected toward my children.
Okay, but towards your wife-to-be, you feel a distance.
I feel a distance.
Yeah, so so if I were to ask you this question, you're going to have to reach for this one, but it's a common form of a way that people disconnect. If I were to ask you, are you angry at her? And you were to dig for an answer, what would you find?
I would say yes.
Yeah, what are you mad about?
Well, you know, we just had issues in the past with, with cheating and such and forth. I mean, but I've done 30 times worse things than her, you know, in the past, so I can't really point any fingers too much. But I just don't know if my heart has it in me to forgive. You know, I think that's kind of like for the big guy.
Well, it may be for, you know, just to get somebody in the middle of it to solve this problem before you two get married, because what you've got is you probably have anger working both ways. And now when a couple decides to get together and there's this anger in the middle, that's so much so that they feel completely separated from each other and distant from each other, when that distance is there, the one who suffers from it is the children, you see? Now the children get involved in this. So somehow you should be able to fix it. It's fixable. Even though I know you think you could never forgive, if you could never forgive, marriage is the wrong idea. You know, because then it's going to be vengeance all your life.
I forgive, but I just still feel something in between us. And it's like, I don't want to leave, but at the same time, I don't want to sleep in the bed.
Did you ever think of seeking some kind of help with this, like a couples counselor?
Yeah, we've done that, but I don't think we ever really followed through with it. We did about four sessions, and then when one of us hears the wrong thing, it's over.
Yeah, of course, that makes a lot of sense. You just need somebody. You need somebody who you like and can trust, you know, somebody decent in the middle. And that's what I recommend. And I see that you've made the effort of doing it, which is beautiful. You know, you've made the effort. You've tried to do it. Unfortunately, with counseling of all sorts, when you hit it bad and you find the wrong person, it kind of throws off the very effort of it, and that's not such a good idea. You know, it's worth trying, but unfortunately it has to be correct.
Yeah.
So, my friend, I wish you the best. If you ever need any help with it, just let me know. Maybe I could help you find the right person.
Thank you. I appreciate
it. Don't just continue getting married when you feel so distant.
Yeah.
Okay, thank you for calling in.
All right. Thank you.
Sure. This is Armand DeMille with you. We're just about out of time. I have to be going.
Okay. All right. Bye-bye.
I have to be going. I will be back with you tomorrow at 1 p.m., my friends. You can hear what we have going today and the website, thepositivemind.com, or at wbai.org. Send me an email. Let me know your response.